Welcome back to another episode, everyone. Today we have a very special guest joining us for our podcast. We are sitting down with the lovely, wholesome, and truly inspiring Sarah, who is a dear friend of ours, to talk about living with POTS, her journey receiving a diagnosis, and her road to recovery. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode. I am Kat. I am a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist.
And together we are.
I hate this intro so much.
Why?
It's so cringy every time.
Oh, why do we keep sucking at this introduction?
I'll play along. Together we are the Psychology Sisters. Woohoo!
Today we have a very exciting episode for you guys. It has been an episode we have been waiting for such a long time. We've organized it a few times and things have come up, more specifically coronavirus. But today we have finally got our dear friend Sarah here to talk through her experience with living with a chronic illness. Sarah, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. And thanks so much for having me. I'm really stoked to be here. And I've never done anything like this, so I'm pretty excited.
It's your first podcast. We are so honoured to have you on here.
So honoured.
Thank you.
Well, we're both so, so excited to have you here, Sarah. So we thought we would jump straight into the episode. And there might be a few people asking themselves when they see this episode, what exactly POTS is. So can you give us an idea of exactly what POTS is for anyone who doesn't really know exactly what POTS is?
Yeah, sure. Well, POTS is probably one of the most interesting but tricky conditions to explain. So I think it's probably easier for the listeners, probably make more sense if I broke it down firstly, starting with what POTS stands for, this strange acronym that could mean so many things.
I tried to practice how to say it and I was like, you know what? I'm not going to say it.
There's a lot of, obviously POTS has many different meanings and I had no clue what it meant when I first got diagnosed. But basically POTS stands for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And to the average person who's not a medical professional, that is probably just a mouthful of gibberish, as it was to me when I first heard it. But basically, it's a syndrome. So there is a bit of differing opinion on whether you would label it a chronic illness or not, because some people recover. So in that sense, it's not lifelong, but then some people don't. But it is essentially a syndrome. People tend to get POTS after a virus, illness, or any kind of traumatic incident on the body. So that seems to trigger POTS. It's not life-threatening, but it does affect your autonomic nervous system as well as your circulation. And now the reason your autonomic nervous system is so, so important, and I swear no one gives their autonomic nervous system enough credit. It literally controls all of your autonomic and vital functions that keep you alive. So everything from your heart rate, blood pressure, breathing, digestion, everything. So POTS literally affects all of those responses in the body, which is why it can be, I guess, so debilitating. And a lot of people can end up in a wheelchair or on disability support with it because of that. So yeah, and the main part, I guess, that POTS affects of those functions is your heart rate. And most people think, yeah, like I've had a high heart rate before, or, you know, when I get anxiety, my heart rate races. But this is kind of to an extreme sense where, like, you, like, for example, I'd try to stand up or move positions and my heart rate within seconds would shoot up to 160 beats per minute. Mm. And I'd just kind of be so out of breath and collapse. I'd just be lying on the floor. Basically every day it felt like I was having a heart attack. So yeah, that's probably the best way to paint the picture of POTS. And it was probably the most terrifying thing I've ever experienced.
Yeah, that sounds completely terrifying. Tell us about what kind of life you were living before POTS, and when did POTS begin? How did you kind of realized that something was wrong?
So before POTS, my life was pretty much like any other healthy 27-year-old female, I guess. Very busy, very social. I was living in an apartment near the beach. So I'd actually just moved back from Melbourne. So moved back to Sydney after living in Melbourne. And I was just really happy to be home. And my career had kind of taken off. So I was organizing a lot of events with work and traveling heaps. So I'd kind of describe my life as really, really busy at that stage. And then I was overseas with work in Singapore and Malaysia. It was March last year. So it's been just over a year. And I got this really bad virus. And, you know, when you like, you get a cold or flu or virus, you just, you know, you might give it a week, take some Codral and you're better again. But I just couldn't, I just didn't get better. It was really strange. And I knew something wasn't right after a couple of weeks when the virus, it kind of turned into this like dry chronic cough that lasted for about 4 months. Yeah. And like, I guess you just know your body and you know when something isn't right. And with the cough, it then felt like I was constantly out of breath and dizzy until one day I just collapsed at work, and that's when the investigations kind of began.
Wow. So run us through, I guess, that would have been a lot of emotions for you, from going from thinking it's just a simple virus to, you know, hospitalization. That's a big jump. So tell us about the emotions and I guess like the whole journey from being hospitalized and I guess kind of starting to realize that this was actually really serious and yeah, kind of the lead up to the diagnosis. And I know that took a while for you. So could you talk us through, I guess, from that little part of your journey?
Yeah, sure. It's a, yeah, kind of a bit of a story, but I think most of us, when we get sick, we always expect to recover. We don't ever expect something to linger on. So that was really challenging emotionally, to have something that wasn't going away. A really interesting part of POTS actually that I should mention is a lot of people can end up with POTS after a traumatic event. So it might be a traumatic childbirth or a car accident, or even an extremely emotional traumatic event can trigger POTS in some people. And they don't know why. They don't know if maybe it's like some people have a threshold and their body can only take so much. But the majority of patients, they end up with POTS usually after a really bad virus. And I happen to fall into that category. And yeah, it took a really, really long time, I guess, to get a proper diagnosis, mainly because POTS overlaps with so many other things. Like POTS overlaps with anxiety, for example. So POTS is often mistaken for anxiety. The other issue with POTS symptoms is they're often relieved when you lay down or sit. So you might recall, like when you go to the GP, they'll always have you sitting down when they take your blood pressure. Like they'll put the cuff around your arm to take your blood pressure and your heart rate. So you're sitting down. So with a POTS patient, it's really easily missed, because usually when they present to the GP, they're sitting down or they're lying down in a hospital bed. So their blood pressure and heart rate's being taken while they're lying down and not when they're standing up or moving positions. So yeah, the average time frame for getting a POTS diagnosis is around 3 years.
Wow.
Because of that. But for me, I managed to get a diagnosis within a few months, which was really lucky. And I think a few things helped with that.
Firstly, your sheer determination. Yeah.
You were gung-ho on getting a diagnosis.
Yeah, I was like not taking no for an answer. I think also I had had anxiety in the past, so I was able to distinguish pretty quickly like the difference between the two, even though they were similar, could tell it was something else. And I think the fact that I also had the benefit of my job, where I work in a medical faculty at a university, so I had the opportunity to email cardiologists and speak to heaps of people about kind of what I was going through. But I think I had seen, like, it's gonna sound ridiculous, but I'd seen like 16 doctors. Wow. I think I had gone to hospital. We worked out. I went to emergency, like got taken to hospital like 8 times. And it got to the point where I had to move back in with my parents because I needed a full-time carer. Like I could not shower. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't walk. So I was emotionally and physically just drained. And it was going like, even though my journey to getting a diagnosis was a lot quicker than others, like, as I said, some people can take 5 years. Those 4 months were, it felt like a lifetime. And we just went through numerous tests. At first they thought I had a blood clot, and then it wasn't that. And then blood tests and like brain MRI, then they thought something was wrong with my heart, and then I was diagnosed with asthma, and it was just like all these things, and just not knowing, I think, is so terrifying. And especially for someone like me, like someone who was already fearful of all those things and already worried about health, and then for me to go through it is like, but I think it would be terrifying for anyone. I mean, one day you're perfectly fine. And
was that like frustration, Sarah? Because I can imagine that would be so frustrating. You going, you know, you needing a full-time carer, moving back with your parents, you know, you even just basic tasks like showering, you can't do. And then to be told that it's anxiety or asthma, was there frustration when it got to kind of the end, like getting the diagnosis? You were like, it's so much more, and you felt like people weren't listening. I mean, did it start to kind of turn into some anger?
Yeah, definitely. I had lost just so much trust in the medical community. Even, you know, my own family were like, oh, maybe it is, you know, anxiety, or maybe it is something else. But I think, yeah, like, you know your body, and you know when something is definitely not right. And yeah, I just pushed for answers because I also had a bit of that frustration, and I wanted to know, like, what, I just couldn't keep living like one day I've got this amazing life, and the next, because of a virus, I'm suddenly bedridden, like to the point where I can't go to the bathroom. So yeah, it was frustrated, but very, very determined to kind of get to the bottom of it.
And what led to getting to the bottom of it?
So I think it was like the last doctor I saw before finally being admitted into a cardiac ward. He told me, yeah, it's definitely, you know, anxiety. And by that stage, it was very frustrating as well, because obviously I was anxious because I didn't know what was wrong with me. So yes, I did have anxiety, but it was because of something else. And I think the other frustrating part was they were just dismissing anxiety as well, which, you know, anxiety needs to be addressed. It's its own issue that needs to be addressed. But I found, yeah, a lot of doctors were just dismissing it, and it's all in your head. It's just anxiety. And, you know, nothing is just anxiety. So
anxiety's hard on its own, let alone having a chronic illness to go with it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like they both feed into each other as well. Like your anxiety exacerbates your POTS symptoms, and not knowing what your diagnosis is was obviously exacerbating your anxiety.
Yeah, it was like a vicious circle. Yeah, and that definitely each one was making the other worse. But yeah, I kind of did a heap of research on Google, of course, which I usually would not recommend, but in this instance it worked out for me. And I knew I had POTS. I found it online, and I was like, that's what I have. This is it. Like, this is what I've been going through. And I had a bad episode where my mom had to call an ambulance, and finally I was admitted to a cardiac ward, and I stayed there and I was monitored for a few weeks. And I remember when I walked in for the first time, I actually made them, like in the emergency department, take my heart rate standing up, because again, they put me straight in a bed. And I was like, no, this can't happen again. I need them to diagnose me. And so they put the ECGs on me and got me to stand up, and my heart rate shot up to like 170. and the machines were like beeping and going crazy. And I was like, I'm pretty sure this is called POTS syndrome and I need to see a cardiologist.
Yeah, girl.
And then, yeah, they eventually, yeah, they got me into cardiac ward, which was a long process of more tests just because I had to rule out everything else as well. And they did a tilt, it's called a tilt table test for diagnosis.
I'm so interested to hear what this is. Apparently this is extremely barbaric. Tell me about what a tilt table test is.
Yeah, it's not the most pleasant diagnostic tool. They essentially, so they'd done all the other tests and everything had come back normal. And then by this stage, they suspected POTS when I got them to take my heart rate. But to get like a formal diagnosis of POTS, they make you do this tilt table test and they basically tie you up to a table in a room. You're not allowed to have anyone with you. And then they jolt you upwards and force you to stay there standing for 20 minutes, which for someone with POTS is just, and when you're not medicated, it's like, you're kidding me. And then they inject, they spray the stuff up your nose, which makes you pass out. So they like force you to faint so that they can get all your, like they can just see kind of what your heart rate and blood pressure does. But they're getting rid of that test because they can get all the information they need from just getting you to stand up and putting a blood pressure cuff on.
You need to tie you to a table to get that data.
No. And it was so barbaric. And I actually refused to have the spray because I was like, I've passed out already. I don't need to be forced to pass out.
That would have been quite traumatic, that experience.
Yeah, the whole thing was. And I think on the one hand, I felt validated when I got the results. Like I finally felt like, look, I'm not crazy. It's not all in my head. And I felt extremely grateful and relieved that it wasn't life-threatening. But on the other hand, like when I got the tilt table test results, I had a cardiologist come in and tell me, you have this condition, only 50% of patients recover and 25% end up in a wheelchair permanently. And at that point in time, I was in a wheelchair and I couldn't even take myself to the bathroom. So I was like, well, that's me. I'm in the 25% already. And then I was told the average recovery time, if I did recover, would be like 2 to 5 years. So yeah, it was a lot, I guess, to take in. And I was, I think at that point, left with a really big choice, either to focus on the 50% that recover or the 50% that don't. So I just chose then to believe that I'll recover and that won't be me. But even if it was me, you know, I'll have the tools to get through it and I've got the support to get through it. So
tell us about, like, obviously during this time before the diagnosis and when you got the diagnosis, how did that impact on relationships, social life, like work life? Tell us how it kind of impacted you in that way.
So work were amazing, so supportive. At the university, they just said to take, and I guess it does help working in health and being surrounded by doctors and specialists. They obviously care about you and they're very supportive of looking after yourself. So they just said, take all the time you need, your job will still be here. So that was really helpful. But I had to give up work. I couldn't work for, I think it was maybe 3 months. And then I gradually eased my way back in with a couple of days a week. Social life was non-existent and has been for the past year. And relationships, it massively impacted. My family and my boyfriend, they all had to become, like, take on this role of caregivers. And I relied on them for everything. Yeah, there was one point I wasn't even strong enough to shower. So like my boyfriend had to just do everything for me. So it is difficult when the dynamics change and someone has to become your caregiver that wouldn't usually at all take on that role.
And I can imagine that would have been really, really difficult going from someone who was very independent, very successful, you know, very social, going from that to, you know, going through this really traumatic journey to being diagnosed and then having to, you know, I guess, give up your autonomy and independence and, you know, I guess having all that control taken away from you and not having any other choice but to rely on your family and your boyfriend, you know, to survive.
Yeah, definitely. I just had to let go of all control. And even in hospital, I had to just let go of all control, like let the nurses shower me and take care of me and like, yeah, even to the point of going to the toilet, like things you would never want to anyone else to be part of. And you just have to give up that control and trust that, you know, your support network will help you. And mine did. They all were amazing. So I couldn't have gotten through it without them at all. So
that's such a vulnerable place to be in.
Yeah. And I think just, yeah, like you said, my independence was a big thing for me. Like I even lived alone for a long time and never really had to rely on other people. So that was a big blow, I guess, losing that.
Mm. Obviously, there's been a huge worldwide pandemic, in case you hadn't realized. tell everyone, I guess, about how coronavirus or the COVID-19 pandemic has affected you, because I can imagine for someone with a chronic illness, that would be quite anxiety provoking too. I mean, it sounds like you were kind of on the road to recovery and then to experience a pandemic. I can imagine that would have been really hard for you to come to terms with, and it's almost like another challenge for you to get through. So talk us through that.
I definitely felt triggered by COVID. I think it was around March that COVID kind of started becoming a big thing in Sydney, and that also marked 1 year since I had first gotten sick with the virus. So I did feel like I had just started to get my life back. I'd started to leave the house again. So actually through all of this, I ended up seeing a psychologist who was worried that I was developing like phobia of leaving the house because I just didn't leave the house. But she was hesitant to ever diagnose me with anything just because there was good reason that I felt that way. Like I was worried that I might pass out or, you know, have the symptoms come up while I was out. And I just felt safer being at home because, you know, at work I'd passed out and there were all just different events that had happened.
What you had experienced.
Yeah. So, but I mean, POTS it's tricky where it just gets worse. If you obviously laying down relieves the symptoms and lying in bed, the symptoms go away. So naturally that's what you want to do, but you can't spend your life in bed and becoming more deconditioned, which just makes the symptoms worse. So exercise is like really a key part of trying to get the blood flow working properly again. So it's kind of like pushing through that and going out and trying to get some kind of normality back into my life was really important. But I just struggled with it so much. And yeah, I just kind of stayed within my four walls for ages. And my psychologist actually started to get me to do just little like gentle exposure therapy, where I drive to the shops and just wait in the car or just practice driving again, practice little things like just quickly going in to try and get bread. And then if I made it back to the car without anything happening, that was a win for me. And I got really good at it. And I got to the point where I actually sat in and was able to go through a shopping center without anything happening. So we were really excited to start doing more of that exposure therapy, to the point where I could, you know, start socializing again and going to weddings again and stuff like that. And then COVID, like a slap in the face hits and I'm forced to be back in these four walls. But yeah, it's okay. Like nothing really changed for me, because that's what I was going through the past year anyway. So it was, in terms of lifestyle, nothing really changed, but I definitely felt triggered by COVID in the way that I just thought people weren't taking it seriously. And I had just been through this year of hell, and I knew what a virus could do and how much it could change your life. And it just seemed like everyone was saying, you know, it's just like the flu, or it's just a virus. So that scared me quite a bit, because I'm like, I know what a perfectly healthy person with no pre-existing medical conditions, I know what can happen, and it wasn't even COVID that hit me. So yeah, but I do think if anything, COVID can be a real eye-opener to others in how, you know, some people with chronic illness or disabilities have to live their entire lives. Like every day they're isolated, and they the only thing they may look forward to is going out for a walk, and that's just how they have to live their life. So, and I had no idea, like a newfound appreciation for those that live with a disability as well, when I was originally in a wheelchair.
It sounds like, I guess, your mental health, Sarah. I mean, it sounds like you had been through a roller coaster of emotions, from the not knowing to receiving a diagnosis and then recovery and then COVID. That's a lot of emotions to experience in the short span of a year. And how was your mental health through all of this? Like, did you have really bad days or weeks, or do you think you're generally pretty positive?
I think I was more positive. Initially, no. I think I was just in a state of shock initially, and I went through stages. I think firstly, like, just grief, like I just missed my old life and I couldn't believe this was happening to me, and I kind of fell into a bit of a victim mentality for a while. And when I wasn't getting better, because once I got my diagnosis, I expected, okay, now I've got my diagnosis, now they'll give me a medication and I'll be better and I'll continue on with life. And the problem with POTS is there's no FDA approved medication, so everything is trial and error, which means you have to just trial different medications kind of and hope that they work. But they're only treating the different symptoms, they're not really going to cure POTS or anything like that. So yeah, I initially just thought, okay, I'll get better once I've, you know, figure out what this is. And then when I didn't, and months had passed after being released from hospital and I was still struggling, and that's when I think the real kind of grief hit me. And yeah, I still go through moments, like it's still a battle, but I'm definitely so much more positive about it now. And I think I've always tried to look at it as, so I actually don't use the words like chronic or, and I, this is just a personal thing. I know a lot of people that I speak to with POTS like disagree, but I don't like to use that, or flares or setbacks or anything like that. I just like to focus on recovery and getting better, and that's all I focus on, because I think it's really easy with any illness to let it become your identity and just really feel like a victim. So I did go through that stage, but I'm trying to just move away from that now and stay positive.
How are you now? Talk us through your recovery and how you have been able to maintain an admirable amount of positivity and getting through what has been a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely so much better now. I don't use a wheelchair. I'm back to work just part-time at the moment from home, but I'm walking 10,000 steps most days, which I didn't think I'd ever be able to do again. I think I was only walking like a couple of hundred steps at the start. And yeah, even on the weekend, I did a 2-hour hike for the first time. So,
congratulations.
Yeah, so they're things I never thought I'd be able to do again. And I still know that I have a long way to go. But yeah, I feel that recovery is closer than ever now. And yeah,
And I guess looking back on where you have been to where you are now and being able to reflect on your progress and recovery, what has that felt like for you?
Yeah, I feel so, so grateful and happy, and every time, like, so proud of myself as well.
So Sarah, last time I caught up with you and we were talking about everything you had been through, you mentioned a couple of things which I had, someone who had never heard of POTS before, found really, really interesting. And one of those things was, I guess, the neuroscience and mind-body connection part of recovery and females experiencing POTS. Can you talk us through those two things?
Yeah. So there are some interesting things about POTS, which is why I've actually found it fascinating, like learning about it while I've been going through it as well. So something like 90 or 95% of people that get POTS are female, and they're usually in their 20s and 30s. And it's growing year on year. So it's just becoming more common, which just blew my mind because I had never heard of it prior to diagnosis. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting that, you know, people might've had it lingering. They're trying to do more research, but people may have had it lingering their whole life in the background, and then they weren't aware, perhaps, and then something has triggered it to come out really severely. And it's almost like the body gets stuck in this on switch almost. And you girls would know all about it, like a chronic stress response or that fight or flight response. So obviously when your body's got a virus that it's fighting, or an illness, or if you're recovering from something, your body kind of goes into that response. And then with POTS, it's almost like it gets stuck there and it doesn't go back. So I actually did a lot of research into it just because love my specialists, and like I was all for, usually I'd be very anti-medication, but I was just going to take whatever I could to get better. And that has all been, you know, very helpful. And my physio and exercise has been really, really helpful. But I also looked into the other connection with POTS, which is the connection with that it has with the brain and the vagus nerve. And they actually say that POTS is kind of a little bit like a limbic system impairment. And you guys would know about the limbic system, you know, it's part of the brain involved in our behavioral responses, and especially when it comes to behaviors we need for survival and our fight or flight response. So I did a lot of research into that, and I actually did some programs looking at that and how to kind of calm that response and get it back to a normal, like stabilized response, so that when I stand up, it's not going haywire. And yeah, just so many interesting things came out of that. When I delved into the mind body connection, there is just so much to learn. Like the power of the mind to heal is just, yeah, insane. And I read a really good book called The Body Keeps Score. And there was another one, I listened to like stuff about like Mind Like Body was a really good podcast. And yeah, there were just different apps and a program that I did, which yeah, it was amazing when you get into the science behind it all.
Body Keeps a Score is a great book. I remember that was a recommendation when I was at uni about how trauma lives in the body.
Yeah. Yeah. Which it's so interesting because POTS is triggered
by trauma.
By trauma. And whether it might be that your brain perceives a virus as a really, really traumatic event, or whether it's a car accident, or like I said, some people get it from childbirth, like a really traumatic childbirth. And then it just kind of gets stuck. And I'm just by kind of using some of those techniques and looking into neuroplasticity and the ability to change our brain and change neural pathways has been fascinating and helped so, so much, along with medication and other things. But I think it really got me out of that victim state and into let's like try and get my body back to normal and recover. And yeah,
it's a lot harder what you've done, Sarah, to just get up and change your attitude and to learn as much as you can about it. Like, that's a lot of hard work from your end, and I can imagine that you're so motivated and positive. And it's, I think a lot of people do fall so easily into victim mentality, especially with a chronic illness. It's a natural response, isn't it? A bit of learned helplessness, because you think, well, I've tried everything and I just don't know. But it sounds like with POTS, it's perhaps a little under researched, and you're probably going to be the one that brings home the treatment. I'm going to see you on some scientific paper. So I really just want to commend how amazing it is to see someone to be so, you know, just yearning for that knowledge to understand exactly what's going on. So it's amazing to see.
Yeah, I think that it's good if, in a way, if you first are diagnosed with something, to connect with people, like people who are going through a similar thing. Like, I connected to everyone. Like, I hashtag POTS and searched everything and connected to every Facebook group there was, just because I wanted to feel part of, you know, what I wanted to have that support of people who
you
understood.
Can relate. Yeah. It's a shared experience. Yeah.
So, but then I think that can also be to your detriment, where, you know, you are all sharing learned helplessness and saying, you know, this is our life and we'll never recover. So I kind of backed away from that a little bit, because it is really easy to stay stuck there and, like I said, have it become your identity, which is so understandable. But I think it's important to remember that you're so much more than any illness.
So Sarah, given that you've been through an incredibly inspiring last 12 months and you've gotten through some really tough stuff and you've maintained an incredibly positive outlook on all of this, what advice would you give to someone who is going through something quite similar, or any kind of health, like long-term or short-term health condition, that are kind of feeling a little bit like you were at the beginning, a little bit overwhelmed or a bit unsure of what was happening? Is there any advice that you would give to someone who's going through something like that?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, just know that it gets better, and to try and get to the root cause if you can, so that you can get the right treatment path. Because, like I said, I hate to think how many people are out there and they may be suffering with POTS and they just haven't gotten the diagnosis, so it would just be impossible to try and get better. So if you can, like, you know, find the right doctors and the right support, that's definitely helpful. I found having a psychologist really helpful as well. Just someone who I could go to who wasn't a friend or a family member or a partner, and who I could just talk to about what I was going through. And yeah, I think staying away from Google, even though I said that's how I figured out that I had POTS. But I mean, once you know what you have, just stay away from Google and researching and symptom checking and constantly scanning the body for sensations. It's not helpful. I would constantly check my heart rate. I had a Fitbit and I was just constantly checking to make sure it was okay. And it wasn't, like, I was still recovering. So when I would stand up, my heart rate would shoot up and I'd look at it on my Fitbit and freak out. And I know that heaps of people with POTS do that. It's like you become obsessed with checking your vitals. And, you know, it's just best to trust your body and trust that it has an innate ability to heal itself, and not look at those things and not focus on those things, and just focus on the path forward, I think.
And that sounds like a really valuable lesson you've learned. And I guess you have a lot more insight and understanding to your body. And I guess this experience has made you a lot more attuned to your body, because I can imagine that's only a very natural response to being in that situation where you've lost all control of your body. I can imagine it would be quite difficult to learn to trust your body again when you have been so vulnerable and you've had to kind of succumb to your illness.
What's happening?
Yeah. I can imagine that being really, really difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, as humans, we naturally want to have control, and especially over our own body. It's like, if I don't have control over my autonomic responses, or how do I have control over anything?
Daily functions.
Yeah, like going to the bathroom, like anyone wants to have control over that. And I guess, learning to trust my body that it wants to do right by me, and it's keeping me alive. And trusting, I did go through a terrible time trying to get a diagnosis, but trusting in the medical community again, that, they're all just trying to do the right thing, and they're all on my team and on my side wanting to find answers. So definitely a challenging part, but I think a really important part of the journey.
Definitely. Really good advice, I think, for anyone going through something like this, or any health condition, is finding the right people. They're not all going to be perfect, especially the first few doctors, but as you know, Sarah, researching and finding the right ones that are, finding your team. I love that. And yeah. Something that I can see with you, Sarah, is you have at times, I'm sure, like you've said, you've had days where it has felt really frustrating, and you may have felt a little bit like, oh, why is this happening to me, kind of thing. But I feel like throughout this experience, you've always remained so hopeful. Like,
yeah,
generally you've been like, okay, like, what is the next step to getting better, or where can I find the right treatment or the right doctor? I find that so inspiring and so admirable that even on your worst day, you haven't kind of let it defeat you. You've always remained just that little bit hopeful that tomorrow is going to be a bit better.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's good to, because when I had bad days, it's easy to then go into this spiral of this is terrible. But I started to record the wins. I literally wrote them down, and I'd write down, and it sounds so cliche, but just writing down all the things I was grateful for. Like, and if you start from the top of your head to the bottom, like go down through your whole body, there are so many things to be grateful for in my body. That's, my eyesight, my ability to speak, my brain, that you could go through every body part, and there's still so many things that are working, are functioning, that I can be grateful for. And writing that down every day and reminding myself, and writing down my wins, like, I got a loaf of bread today, or I walked 500 steps and that's now 10,000 steps. So yeah, it's really great to record even the small wins, I think.
Definitely. I love that.
Sometimes it takes going through something so awful to appreciate those things, doesn't it? Especially our body is amazing. And especially when you had been through POTS, you still were able to find things of your body that you were so grateful for. And I certainly see with clients, it's not until you go through something so awful or traumatic that you start to appreciate those parts of yourself. So it's just a nice reminder, I guess, to listeners as well, that we are so lucky to have a functioning body.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think we could say that it is a really good reminder, even for people, without not going through anything, just to remember to take the small things, like appreciate the small things as well. Because sometimes, if everything else, like I read this really good quote about everything is so important until you don't have your health. And then that's the only thing that's important. And so when people make excuses for not, like, neglecting their health, I think that's a really good reminder to put it at the forefront and make it a priority, because you can't do anything without it.
Definitely.
Love that. Well, Sarah, thank you for your incredibly inspiring, positive energy and story that you've brought to our Tuesday night. We are so grateful that you came on and shared your story. And I hope that for anyone listening who is going through something similar or knows someone who is, that this is helpful. And I hope that you're feeling positive after listening to Sarah. I know I am. You have a very positive energy about it. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your beautiful story.
Thanks so much for having me, girls. My first ever podcast.
Probably won't be your last, now you've got a cool little headset you're using. All right, guys. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next time. Bye. Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you want to see more, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. To make sure that you never miss another episode, please hit the subscribe button in the podcast app. If you know someone who might enjoy this episode, we would love you to share this with them. Please note the content shared in this episode is purely educational and does not replace personalized advice from a mental health professional. See you next week for more spicy science and sexy self-help.